Hello and welcome to episode 15 of the Sports Law Podcast from Blackstone Chambers with me, Nick DiMarco KC. Today's episode is called Life as a Sports Lawyer because I know so many of our listeners are intrigued to know more about what sports lawyers actually do and how they end up working in an area so many of us love to work in. Now, I'm delighted today to be joined by four good friends, all of whom are first-rate sports lawyers across the industry. We've tried to give you a really good cross-section of talent, experience, and expertise with today's panel. First, we have Caroline McCrory. Caroline is the Chief Legal Officer of the new Cadillac Formula One team. I first got to know Caroline many years ago when she was Director of Legal and Commercial Affairs at Mercedes F1. After that, she went on to be General Counsel at Leicester City Football Club and then Chief Legal Officer for the Birmingham 2022 Commonwealth Games before returning to F1. So she has the highest level experience across a range of sports. She's done deals with everyone from Michael Schumacher to Lewis Hamilton, and you may have seen her with Keanu Reeves on the excellent TV series Braun, the Impossible Formula One Story. Ian Taker is the legal director of Watford Football Club, where he's been for a number of years now, and I've had the great pleasure of working with him on a number of interesting cases. Before that, Ian was a commercial sports consultant with a particular focus on intellectual property, media and technology, investments, bidding and staging of events. Ian also worked as in-house lawyer at Southampton Football Club and senior lawyer for Comic Relief. Angelique Richardson is a very busy sports lawyer in private practice as a solicitor at Lawrence Stevens, especially well known for her work in boxing, where her clients have included Amir Khan, Chris Eubank Jr. and Joshua Buatsi, amongst many others. Before that, Ange was a solicitor at Fries, where she also acted in a number of football disputes, including for Derby County Football Club, along with myself. And Ange is also an athlete, a successful swimmer, and a record-breaking British champion in the 25 metres bifins. Finally, we have Blackstone Chambers' very own Celia Rooney. Celia's ranked as one of the very best sports law junior counsel in the whole country. She's acted in a whole range of sports disputes, most notably and recently for Everton Football Club in their various PSR, financial fair play disputes with the Premier League, as well as in a number of other football and motorsports cases. Often with great pleasure for me, alongside me as my junior, and sometimes with causing me great stress as an opponent. She has a very broad range of experience, as do the whole of our panel. So let's get down to asking them what being a sports lawyer is really like and what they do. So if I can start with you, first of all, Caroline, just give us a couple of minutes, if you will, about what your role actually entails, what you do.
Okay, thank you for the intro. So as you said, Nick, I'm Chief Legal Officer at what is the first new Formula One team that's entered onto the grid in sort of in the last 10 years. So kind of made a little bit of history in getting our entry to start competing in 2026. So as Chief Legal Officer, I've been in the team sort of for about 15 months and I literally do everything or everything that comes past my desk. I'm building a team and now we've got a small legal team, but basically everything from, you know, every contract that passes my desk on a daily basis. The main focus for the first 12 months that I was at the team was really getting this the entry. So very much involved with negotiations with the commercial rights holder, the regulatory body, our shareholders, also working with our new shareholders because we're owned by General Motors and an entity called TWG Global, which are two big US entities in setting up the whole corporate structure that also sits behind the team. So all of that was all very much linked with us actually getting the entry over the line as well. So it was a lot of working with US lawyers in all different capacities over in the US, as well as I said, with the commercial rights holder in trying to negotiate what we needed to do to satisfy a lot of the conditions to get this onto the grid, which was pretty much a full-time job for 12 months. And we had a lot of ups and downs, but finally in March this year, received the good news that we were finally in. So Now we're actually in as an entrant to start competing in 2026. As I said, it's that normal everyday work that you would do as a Formula One team. So all the contracts, we need to get drivers on board. We have no drivers signed yet. It will be, we've signed up to the Concorde Agreement, which is the agreement that all the teams sign up to with the commercial rights holder in relation to the governance of the commercial rights of the sport. It will be, I work closely with the HR team on employment matters, brand and intellectual property, actual property. So we've taken on leases and property to house the team, both in the UK and in the US. Actually, we've got a big HQ in the US and a satellite HQ in the UK. So very transatlantic, the work at the moment, working a lot with our US colleagues and our shareholders, learning quite a lot about US law as well, which is always fascinating, as well as I say, the normal day-to-day work that crosses my desk, including a lot of regulatory work at the moment. There's a lot of changes. There's a whole new regulation set coming into the sport next year. And there's a lot of tweaks to that that are happening at the moment, and really kind of understanding how that affects us as a new team as well, and all the new implementation of that across the whole team.
Well, fascinating, and congratulations for being the first in 26 years,
I think it's something like 12 or 13 years.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah. There's been new teams, but they've bought existing teams, whereas we have started right from scratch. So we're a startup.
Yeah.
So it started with 3 employees. We're now up to about 500. So we've grown in the space of sort of 2 years from nothing into a, hopefully will be a fully operational Formula One team.
Yeah, incredible. And it sounds like most of your work is what we might describe as sort of the commercial corporate side. Litigation is probably just a small amount. Is that fair?
Well, we try to avoid it.
No good for us.
At the moment in particular, we're trying to be, you know, we're toeing the line. We're trying to be, you know, good. We're the new kids on the block. We want to do things properly. We don't want to get into trouble. So if we can avoid it, so sorry, Nick, we might not be sending too much work your way, hopefully, in the next few months. But as you say, Formula One generally is probably quite a litigious sport, or it has historically been quite a litigious sport, mainly because of as things normally are, it's power, money, competitiveness. You know, always the way that the sport is that the teams will always try to push the regulations to the limit. So you're all, you know, similar to football, I guess, as well. You know, you're always trying to, we have a financial cap. So you're trying to interpret the rules in the best way possible in order to achieve. So you're spending your money in the most efficient way in order to be the most, to improve your performance on the track. So the way that you interpret those rules are the types of things which you might end up having a dispute about, but hopefully that won't happen to us. We're going to stay. Yeah.
And Ian Taker, I mean, how does that compare to football? You have a similar role, but in a football club in Watford. Is it a similar sort of division of work? What's your role? What do you do?
Yeah, again, I think it's very much as sort of talked about. A lot of it is dependent on where the business is at the time. So at the moment, obviously, it's transfer window, or it is at the time of recording. And therefore, a lot of the focus is on the preparation for next season, bringing new players in, for us bringing new head coach and staff in, moving players on as well. So there'll be a lot of work. We'll be focused on that. Maybe during the season, there's a little bit of focus on other areas, talking about the regulations, talking about property, litigation. Unlike Carolina, I think we keep you a little bit busier, general rule of thumb. But I think that's by its nature. There is, as always, the looking at the rules and different interpretations of actually where we think they sit. And it has to be an ever-changing, very reactive industry. Frankly, given the level of interest from externals, there is always going to be a huge amount of interest in everything that you do, and therefore you will have sometimes the PR side of it that you need to liaise with the media team. There'll be other times where it's immigration issues that you have to focus on. So it's very business reactive. I work a team of two of us, myself and a paralegal, who's invaluable to me. And actually, every day you do learn new stuff. The reality is, it's cliched, but you don't go in with a, this is what I'm going to do today, world. Some of it will be what flags up. And it's incredibly varied and interested. But I think it's a world where you'll influence virtually every single part of the business at some point. Or you'll always be on call to people, whether it's safeguarding, whether it's the real property, intellectual property, retail, commercial. And that's what gives it the variety and that gives it the interest from my side.
And I mean, Watford are obviously a very well-established championship club. They've been in the Premier League in and out. Is it common now for championship clubs to have in-house lawyers, general counsel? I mean, what looking at your colleagues, how common is that setup and how common is it in the Premier League? What do you see?
Yeah, definitely. I think Premier League is sort of established for a while. Not all currently have in-house councils, but I think the vast, vast majority not only just have one, but have a team. Our training ground backs onto Arsenal, for example, and their team is significantly fuller than my team. I think most EFL Championship teams will either have in-house counsel or certainly will almost have a external friend that they go to on a very regular basis, whether it's done as a retainer or not. For me, it's absolutely invaluable, given the importance of the things you do, whether it's playing contracts, whether it's transfers, whether it's another parts of the business operations, for example, is undoubtedly there's enough work to bring someone in-house. And I actually think it's more cost effective and you get to understand the business. Yeah. And that's the real key is not just here is what the problem is. It's how do I provide logical potential solutions to that?
Yeah.
Sometimes if you're doing, for example, a litigation matter, the natural inclination would be, right, you want to pay as little as possible if you're on the wrong side of it. But actually, there might be other considerations. You and I obviously have experience with players going up against regulatory charges. And actually, there may be a stronger preference to, can we make sure the player is available for Saturday than actually getting a 3-game ban down to a 2-game ban. If the game on Saturday is the big one that determines something, and therefore your focus might be slightly different. And I think you get a much better feeling as to what is important to the club as a whole by being there day in, day out and living and breathing it.
And you're a private practice solicitor. So how does that, what do you do? How does that vary from what you've heard? Or how is it similar?
I would say similar to what Ian said in the fact that it is very sort of reactive. No 2 days are the same at all. I'd say overall, first of all, I'm a sports and entertainment lawyer, primarily working on behalf of the athlete or the talent. The majority of my work at the moment is boxing. I'd say that's probably 80% of my practice, and that's both on the contentious side of things and the non-contentious side. So that's looking at, negotiating a promotional agreement for a fighter, picking up, a bout contract for an upcoming fight, commercial deals, so your sponsorship and brand endorsement deals, that kind of thing. But then on the litigious side, boxing, again, is, as you said, it's all about power and money. So we do get into quite a few disputes between, fighters and their managers or fighters and their promoters, which can be quite juicy. So on the other side of my practice, I do a lot of anti-doping work. That's really a growth area for us this year. And Nick and I have worked together on some pretty juicy anti-doping cases together. But again, that's picking up the contentious side of things, but also managing the fighter in terms of, their brand and their reputation and sort of, post-charge career. Like, what is that going to look like for the fighter? And we're kind of taking on a little bit of a, unintentionally, sort of a, not a management role, but a lot of our fighters put a lot of trust in us because we sort of understand the nuances of the industry. And they really trust us to sort of guide them on how they see their career panning out. A little bit of a mix, but really, really fun.
And you've gone from, it, I think if I remember, in your previous firm, you're doing sports work, but you're doing a cross range of a lot of other work. I think you were involved in the post office inquiry, all sorts of other things, to now much more a sports focus. How do you find that change?
I'd always been interested in sport. And at my previous firm, I originally qualified into commercial litigation. So that's where my contentious experience comes from. But I had made it very clear that, I wanted to be involved in sport and, put forward a business case on building that out as a department. And we did end up getting quite a few cases in, but that is something that I wanted to focus on 100% of the time. So made the career move to Lawrence Stevens, and best decision I ever made.
Fantastic. Well, Celia, you are a barrister, and so that's, again, a different, coming at it from a different angle. In what way?
Well, for one thing, I think there's been sort of a different sort of spectrum across what we've heard so far about the extent to which you guys get involved in litigation. That is basically not a choice for me. It's a non-negotiable. You can't avoid it. And I'd say effectively you can do advisory and you can do litigation work as a barrister. I tend to do a lot more litigation because I find it a lot more fun, basically, than the sort of drier advisory work. My own practice is pretty broad. I have a really substantial part of it is sports work, and it's sort of changed over time in terms of originally it was much more small disputes, like on-field disputes, things coming out of referee decisions and the sort of decisions that were sort of contested between regulatory bodies about, you know, are you getting a one-match ban, a two-match ban, etc. Over time, it's sort of grown alongside my commercial practice, and as a result, today, a lot of the disputes that I'm doing are sports, but with a really heavy commercial angle. So whether or not that's going to court, for example, to get an anti-suit injunction on behalf of a cycling team who's in war over their merchandise, whether or not that's Formula One, or at the moment what I'm doing is one of the big IndyCar disputes, which is coming up for trial. I'm actually against Nick on that one. We've got a trial in the next term, but luckily will be fought over.
I'm for the good guys.
So he says. But yeah, and similarly, I know a lot of sports lawyers have been heavily engaged in the PSR, the financial fair play regulations, over the last few years, which I count myself one. So pretty busy, pretty varied, but particularly, I guess, a commercial focus on that side of sport.
Fantastic. So quick fire question now, which is, what did you work on last week that's interesting, Ian?
I think the most interesting thing would be bringing a new player in. So therefore, negotiating with the agent, negotiating with the player. On this one, it was an out-of-contract player, so there's no negotiation with the other club, but still keeping them informed that we wish to get permission to speak to him and bring them in, and then doing the media and announcing him last week. So that will be my short fire. Interesting.
And is this going to be a great player?
All our players are great players. Particularly if anyone's looking to buy any of them.
You definitely have some PR training.
Ange.
Last week, okay. Very full on last week, but I'd say probably the most interesting case I'm working on is we are advising a fighter who tested positive, a lot of inconsistencies and a lot of procedural irregularities. So we're kind of advising that fighter as to the next steps available to him. It'd be a crazy case for sure.
Interesting. Celia.
Well, I continue to represent Everton in its ongoing and its sort of endless battles. At the moment, we're not facing any PSR proceedings, but there's the inevitable sort of fallout and consequences of having been found to be in breach of the rules. I won't go into detail, it's an arbitration. So as a result, effectively, there's ongoing litigation in that respect. Otherwise, again, I won't go into too much detail because I'm preparing for our trial, Nick. And I'm heavily engaged in the expert
ages
evidence.
Away.
Now I understand the question.
Yeah. Caroline.
Okay, so I was actually in New York last week, which sounds more exciting than it was. I was literally locked in a conference room, literally for two full days, while we finalised sort of negotiations on our first team partner deal, which did just get announced. So I'm allowed to say. So we did. We were with Tommy Hilfiger. So all Formula One teams need to be kitted out. So you have to have your, you know, your branded kit, and it's always a little bit competitive about which team looks the best at the beginning of each season. So we've been in negotiations for quite a while, and we just needed to, time was against us. We needed to get it all finalized because the kit needs to be made, for example. So, and we literally flew over, we worked, like the key people were in the room. We didn't leave the room. Well, we did, but not for very long. And we kind of redrafted the documents overnight. We drafted, we had all the right, you know, people in the room to make the decisions on the commercial and the legal side. And I'm kind of doing a mixture of both of those areas. The lawyers from Tommy were also in the room, and we literally drafted, turned drafts around, agreed word in, on the spot and overnight in the space of 48 hours. And we came and we flew back with a sort of an agreed
form document ready to sign. So it was great. It was kind of the way to do it. We just needed everybody there focusing on what needed to be done with no distractions. So it was great, actually. Mm-hmm. And it was really rewarding. It was kind of our first real bit of good news following getting the entry, because it's, you know, you work hard on a lot of these deals and some of them work, so some of them come to something and some don't. But then it was great to get that finalised and then all got announced this week. So yeah, all great.
I hope some of the, I hope they were all very well dressed.
Oh, they were. We met Tommy as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Very good.
Good. Okay. So the most remarkable thing that has ever happened to you as a sports lawyer, or the funniest, or even the most embarrassing, or the worst, the one you would not like anyone to hear about. Tell us what it is. Who should we start with?
Doing this.
Go on, Ian, you
I'll
can
let
start.
You work out which one of those categories it falls. I think the most awkward one ever was a manager of a very high-profile team had come into the training ground to have a chat with the update with the academy. And unfortunately, at the time, he was just about to be released from his current job. And we have a very sizable TV screen in our canteen. And the big breaking news came up behind him. So-and-so set to be sacked by. And the first conversation had been like, how's your day going? Cool. I'll pop back to my office. Thanks. So I think that's the most awkward, definitely. But I think with everything, it's you just get to be involved in so many surreal, amazing elements that you probably need to take a step back, actually, after you finish. The summer of my first year, we had the Elton John concerts type thing, and working on that and getting to be involved in taking my mum to the concert was actually like a really lovely thing. So this is put on because people within the club have spent a lot of time doing it.
Yeah.
I think that would probably be my highlight. Obviously, when we get promoted, that will be the new highlight.
Yeah.
That's next season.
So. Oh, okay. Good. Excellent. Celia.
I have really fond memories of one of the earliest cases I ever did was on behalf of the Football Association out at Wembley, and they conduct these hearings in rooms round in effectively in the boxes in the stadium itself. And I can remember you're trying to cross-examine, it's all very serious, very detailed, trying to put on your sort of most serious face at quite an early stage of my career when, you know, you're relatively fresh-faced, you want people to take you seriously. But every 20 seconds, they kept pressing outside this button, which was, I think they do a tour in Wembley and they can press the button and it's as if the whole stadium erupts in sort of applause and screaming and whooping. And this happened, I'd say, about every minute throughout my cross-examination. And you don't know whether or not to take it well. I guess it's nice to be cheered on as you go, but it was quite hard to do it with a straight face. So that sticks out. I also have memories of cross-examining, I will not name the player, but a player who was done for betting offences, and everything turned on his interpretation of emojis. So whether or not, for example, the winky emoji was actually a suspicious face or actually just a sort of happy, joyous, friendly emoji. And trying to educate a bunch of pretty old senior judges about what, you know, these emojis mean, what legitimate sources of expert evidence you might have on that was all pretty entertaining as well.
Lovely. Caroline.
So yeah, no, this is a tough one because there's kind of all so many stories over the years that you think, but probably, I mean, you touched on it at the intro, Nick, and it's hard to not mention this one. And it was, as well as obtaining the entry as Cadillac, which I must say was pretty remarkable from a personal experience of being involved in that, but it's probably got to be the year of Braun GP and meeting Keanu as a result of that, I guess. It was a story that you probably could never have written. And I think as a lawyer, sort of at that time, I was the only in-house lawyer at the team. So really was responsible for, you know, from the day that Honda decided they wanted to pull out of Formula One and everybody was going to lose their job, to us kind of turning it round, having some lows and we did have to make some redundancies, but then, you know, working as a team and then to try to sort of, and it's, something quite sort of save what as much as we could of what and find a solution to preserve that we could continue to race, to then sort of five of us on the management team being involved in a management buyout. And as a lawyer, in-house lawyer, you would never dream of actually ever having that opportunity of actually owning a small part of an F1 team for a year, and then we win both world championships. And everybody, even the drivers, everybody took pay cuts. It was all literally ran on a tiny budget. We'd negotiated quite a good deal to keep us going for a year. And it was kind of this sort of dream story of teamwork. And it's kind of, you always go back to that if people say, like, what was it like to be part of a special team? It was, it's hard to describe, but everyone just stuck together and in that face of adversity. And then we had this great result. So it's hard to kind of trump that, I think, in anything probably that I've ever done. But yeah, particularly as a in-house sports lawyer, it was quite unique, I think, to be able to experience something like that firsthand.
Yeah. And the TV program, by the way, for those who haven't watched it, is really good. I mean, not to want to say anything bad about Drive to Survive, but if you're a sports lawyer, the Braun documentary is far more interesting. Mm-hmm. Ange?
This is a hard one because we've worked on some really good cases. I'm telling you that in some of those cases we cannot discuss.
We can't say, no.
You know what? One of the cases that I do always go back to, non-sports related, it is the post office group litigation and acting for those 555 claimants of postmasters. That was the first case that I ever worked on. Worked on that for about 5 years, and it's still ongoing now with the compensation scheme. But some of the tactics that the other side used during the High Court trials and through settlement, I've kind of taken those away and, you know, deploy instances of those in everyday matters that I work on. So I'll always go back to that and always be grateful to have worked on a case of that magnitude. But one also that sticks in my mind is the case that we wrapped up towards the end of last year, which for obvious reasons we can't talk about in too much detail, but that was probably one of the biggest arbitrations in this particular sport, where our athlete defendant won on pretty much every single point, didn't he?
He had the best lawyers.
Well, yeah, true. You. But yeah, we got an amazing result. And I'm, to this day, really, really pleased about that. So, yeah.
Yes. It's a shame we all have that so much of our work in sport is in arbitration, which means we can't. Yeah. That's the same in Formula One, isn't it?
Yeah,
as football and boxing.
All the things get leaked.
They always get leaked. That's why it's all so silly about it being in private, because it's all in public anyway. The greatest challenge you face in your work, Ian.
It's depending on whether I want to keep my job. I think the reality is, say, sole qualified lawyer in there is you are one lawyer and there's a business of 200 plus people, and just trying to give enough time, empathy and effort to every single part of the business who generally we want them to come to you when there's a problem. I think that's the hardest thing, is realising that you can't do everything for everyone. You can do your best, but you won't always be able to give a perfect answer to someone. For example, people might have different interpretations of the rules. Sometimes you have to go and say, no, this is the closest we can get. This is what I think the risk is of doing it. And you have to sometimes be on the unpopular side of things. And whilst in-house counsels are general, you very much have to be problem solvers and solution orientated. Sometimes the solution is, just don't take this fight on.
Yeah.
You're better to come to a sensible conversation. And actually, the human element of it on the other side of this is normally, whether it's a player, whether it's an agent, whether it's another club, actually the ability to pick the phone up rather than just send an email that can come across a bit cold. So I think the biggest challenge is understanding what's appropriate at the right time, both the tone and when to fight and when to kind of agree.
And that's as much about being a lawyer as understanding the industry and the commercial side, isn't it?
Definitely.
Yeah. What about being on call 24 hours a day? Is that a problem for... Or dozens of...
Well, once then Caroline flew to New York. That was a few extra hours in the day. It goes with being a solicitor. It goes with the trade. The reality is the owner, the chief exec, the senior exec, or pick up the phone, and it isn't a 9-to-5 job. It's, you can go on a holiday, if something happens, you're going to be one that gets called, I think. No, we'll probably talk about it, but you've got to go with your eyes open. You get immersed in the entire business, and therefore your role is to be available when it's needed. It is tricky. I think having a support network around you who understand that. I have a very understanding partner and two stepdaughters who realise that there will be times when Gladiators or whatever's on telly have to get put on pause while Ian runs going to that top or something. But it being serious, actually, that is quite helpful, having a family around you that realise you're not prioritising your work over them in that sense. But actually, it is quite time sensitive, and by getting it done now, you then can focus and actually have more time doing the bits that you really want to.
Indeed, and many summer holidays I've spent every day in Italy on the phone with you, Ian.
I thought I was paying for the holiday. I thought that was how it worked. But again, that's the other thing is you can go on a holiday, like the work doesn't care where you are.
Yeah.
You might be in the office when something crops up. It's fine if there's a problem and you're on a holiday. I was on holiday with a family member in Barcelona for 5 days when we were removing then current coach and employing another one who needed a work permit.
Yes.
So for a vast majority of the 5 days, I had a beautiful view of Barcelona while working from a laptop screen.
Yeah.
But
you
take the ups and the downs, and I certainly wouldn't swap the opportunity to do what I do for mundane 9-to-5 mm-hmm. consistency.
Yeah.
And it just wouldn't ever cross my mind that I'd want to go.
That's good to hear. Celia, greatest challenge.
I think it's a blessing and a curse, but the volume of work, which is, and that, you know, is despite best endeavours to keep things within manageable proportions, we have, as litigators, just an unpredictable job. And you can be planning on one timetable and then a judge imposes a completely different one and everything changes. And I guess compared to, because I think that's a reality of all lawyers' jobs, but it may be compared to firms or other teams where there's a sort of group of people, quite often on as a barrister you're operating on your own, so when the parameters of things change, it's really the buck stops with you. And there's something quite real about how that comes to bite if you're actually standing up and making submissions at hearing. Mm-hmm. You know, there isn't really any room at that point for anything other than your A game. So I guess it's kind of working out how to deal with that, how to leave space and breathing room in the timetable to allow you to sort of adapt to the unpredictability. But I completely agree that I would never effectively change that for a 9-to-5. There's just not enough room for fun and challenge in that.
I noticed you didn't say Nick being on the other side.
No.
I'm sure I'm far more annoying as a leader.
Sort of similar to what Celia was saying, I guess it's kind of twofold with pace and how quick the industry moves, especially in boxing.
Mm.
You can have an offer for a client for a fight literally 1 hour, and then an hour will go by and it'll be pulled for whatever reason. So it's really about being online like 24/7 to just try and capture that opportunity for the client and, you know, take instructions. Do they want to take the fight? Do they not? Are they ready to get into camp? Do they have enough time to do a full camp and perform the best that they can? So I'd say pace. Pace is probably the biggest challenge that we'll all face. Mm. And naturally just not being able to have a day off.
And of
I can't remember the last time I had one.
Yeah, and our sports are so international. I mean, in boxing, exactly, there's so much going on in the Middle East.
Yeah,
so you've got different time zones going on. And
yeah, 100%. And, you know, there's been many a time where I've had to, you know, repeat dial clients to be like, this is on the table, do you want to take it? And they've woken up in a bit of a frenzy being like, what's going on? But yeah, it's just the game, isn't it? But again, I wouldn't change it for anything. I really do enjoy it.
Karen, greatest challenge.
Okay, all of this is very familiar to me as well. It's probably just not having enough hours in the day.
Mm.
Particularly at the moment, sort of the challenge that we're currently facing is that we're trying to get 2 Formula One cars to the grid. Not only, I mean, to get them to the grid and then be competitive on the grid, mm-hmm. everything is urgent. So every piece of work that crosses our desk as lawyers is urgent. So you end up having the discussions, well, how urgent is urgent? Is it super urgent or middle urgent? Or you're coming up with these new phrases of how urgent is urgent. And that's difficult because everything has to be done and we're doing it in record time and it's all important. So that's sort of a challenge. And then, as you say, it's the time zone. So we're working mm-hmm. UK and US time zones. So,
you know, when the US wakes up, you've then got meetings going on until really late in the evening. And when we were trying to get the entry over the line and the investment of our shareholders, we were doing calls up until 1-2 o'clock in the morning, but you're starting, and that was every day and that was all weekends. And but you're starting at, you know, 7-8 o'clock in the morning as well. So your days are never ending. Mm-hmm. But as you say, the adrenaline and the excitement and the challenge of what you're doing, it just keeps you going. And as I say, you wouldn't change it for anything. And you're learning something new all the time. You know, you're learning from new people, doing new things. But it is, it's like, how do I fit all of this into one day? And then you sort of take one day at a time. You go, right, let's get what we can do today. You know, what's on the top of the list that has to be done? And then not worry too much about the next day. At the minute, that's the way we're kind of having to work because we've got so much to do and so little time to do it. But all great fun.
As someone once described it to me, it's working out which plates are made of rubber and which are made of glass.
Which ones can you put down?
Which ones have to spin?
And, you know, I guess all lawyers are busy in different ways, or not all lawyers, but many lawyers are busy in different ways. But one thing that's common from what you're all saying is, of course, we work in an industry where you have these regular things like a football match or a Formula One tournament or something that happens on an occasion, and everything has to be done around that. You can't just shift it and say, I'll do it on a different date. It's very time sensitive industry. I think you all kind of already started answering the next question, which is, why do you love working in sports law? And certainly all of your passion is coming through, which is great. But why else? What's so good about working in this sector, Celia?
I think it's that at the end of the day, there is actually a real world thing to see at the end of the process. So, and I say that I do some commercial litigation that isn't sports related, and quite often you're just arguing about money and money moves from one bank account to another bank account, all that sort of thing. There's something quite different in sports. And I mean, to give you an example, and I won't go into detail for all the reasons we've described, but I've been representing Everton. I was recently invited up to see their new stadium. It's real. It's there. You're doing a tour. You're walking around something that, you know, was absolutely at the heart of the case that we were doing. And it's just incredibly tangible. And I think you get that in all sorts of sports work. You know, if you're representing an athlete who might be banned, turns out they're not, and actually they go on to have a really successful career. Mm-hmm. You get to see that day in, day out. And, you know, all of the cases that we do, I think, have those real consequences, whether or not it's only that a particular player is not on a pitch, whether or not that it's the big deal gets done, and actually suddenly there's a new team in Formula One. I mean, these are huge, huge commercial processes, but that ultimately have real world effects. And I just think it is particularly acute in the world of sports. You see it.
Ian.
Yeah, I completely echo that. I think it's the tangible output that 5-year-old me used to grow up watching football and being the starry eyed, oh my God, wow, that's that superstar player. And you kind of help bring that to life for other people. Like, kind of, this is literally what I did growing up, was watch football with my family. It was kind of the best memories I had with my dad, who's passed away, relate to football. And a friend of mine's dad turned 80 quite recently, and the manager did like a little video message for him and kind of went and said hello, wrote a letter to him. And it's stuff that makes a practical difference during COVID. And I know a lot of people are going through tough times, but again, having almost that club that reaches out to people and they feel part of something bigger than just being on their own, it is exactly why I kind of love it. I love working and then going at night to go and watch the game. Granted, not all the results across these seasons, but it is that you have something to work towards. I personally wouldn't have the same level of motivation and enthusiasm working on a big data outsourcing project. Mm-hmm. For other people, that is very much, they love that work. Fantastic. I'm not critical of that, but for me, I get to wake up on a Monday, and my first thing isn't, oh, it's a Monday, not just because I've worked Saturday and Sunday, but it's not, oh, it's Monday, how long have I got to get through the weekend? You actually enjoy what you do. Mm. You love being in the training ground, at the factory, wherever that might be. You enjoy what you do, and therefore it's not just work, it's a privilege.
Mm, that tangible point is very true. It's we're recording this on the 5th of June, and on Sunday I went to the National League playoff final, which I never thought I would end up going to at Wembley, between Southend United and Oldham Athletic, mainly because I've done a lot of work for Southend in the past. And it was incredible. You had an attendance of over 52,000 people at Wembley for a National League playoff final. And although I had hoped Southend would win because I was their guest, I was also delighted for Oldham Athletic because you had two clubs who are both proper established Football League clubs who found themselves out of the league. And the what it meant for those fans is, you know, you just can't describe. Caroline?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, every day is different. So you wake up in the morning, you think you've got your to-do list, but it changes. You know, within the hour, there's something new crosses your desk. And I love that. For me, that sort of fast pace. As you said, Nick, you know, the idea that there's a match coming up in a few days or there's a race next week or whatever it might be, and things have to be done for that next event that's happening. So there's no time. You just have to do things quickly. And that, for me, that kind of fits with the way I like to work as well. I love that idea of making decisions, getting the right people around the room, making the right decision to do X, Y, Z, and then facilitating that through the legal route, for example. And that's really rewarding. And then, you know, similar to what Celia said about this whole kind of seeing the real world, you see the product of what you're spending hours upon hours doing. And as you say, whether it's in football and you see the new player comes out on the pitch and you're like, oh gosh, I did that agreement, or you're at an F1 race and you're, you know, there might be a new partner there and you're saying, I worked on that and I've helped get that over the line, or a driver. Same in the Commonwealth Games, when you sit through all the events and it's a really successful event and you think, gosh, I actually played a part in this. As a lawyer, I helped this happen. Makes it really real, and it just is really rewarding from a personal point of view that you see. Because as lawyers, we do spend a lot of time behind the desk. You're drafting, your emails, you're locked away in rooms, finalising contracts or doing deals. But then you see it come to life, whether it's on the pitch or on a racetrack. It's quite unique, actually. It's hard to explain, but it's just so rewarding.
Mm. And Ange, I mean, as you said, you really wanted to target sports law, and now you do it. You're in a team that just does sport and entertainment.
Yeah.
Why? What's so great about it for you?
I think for me, it's all about protecting the athlete. And I used to be an athlete. You know, we had some very difficult circumstances to navigate when we were a lot younger. And I just think I don't want any of my athletes or my clients to go through the same thing. Mm. And a lot of the time with our clients, it's often the ones that are closest to them that are taking advantage of them, you know, whether that's, you know, taking a bigger piece of the pie than what they should be. So for me, it is all about protection, but it's also sort of seeing them flourish in their own respective fields, whether they're, you know, in football, whether they're in boxing. You know, often they come from a really difficult or tough background, and, you know, they've never really had anybody, pardon the pun, in their corner. So we and, you know, my team very much have the same view. We just want to make sure that they are as protected as they can be, because ultimately if we take boxing, for example, no promoter would be in business if it wasn't for the fighters. Do you understand?
Yeah.
So yeah, for me, it is all about making sure that they're protected, but equally going to, you know, these huge fight nights and sort of just taking a step back and thinking, wow, you know, we've got 3-4 clients on this card, including a headliner. You know, we made it happen, or we were integral in making that fight night happen, and it's part of history. So, yeah.
And I think it is thrilling for all of us, isn't it, to see those who we work with or represent succeed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because we know when we work with them, whether it's a football player, a Formula One driver, or a boxer, just how hard they work.
Absolutely.
I mean, everybody kind of knows that, but you don't really realize it until you work closely with these people and you realize just how really hard they work to get to the level they're at.
Absolutely. And I think if they suffer a loss as well, that's when, you know, they really do rely on you then to sort of guide them through next steps, but also kind of just being there as somebody to talk to. Being a lawyer means that you're probably the most trusted person in the circle, and, you know, I feel really grateful that, you know, they think of me in that way, that, you know, they can divulge how they're feeling after a loss, which can be devastating to somebody's career ultimately.
Yeah. Okay, so we're getting near to the final stretch, and we always like to do a sort of how did you get to where you are. So many people listening would probably love to do the kind of jobs you're doing. I'm going to ask you for three top tips in a minute, but first of all, perhaps just a little bit about your background, how you got there before we get the tips, Ian.
Yeah, I think everyone will have a different journey. Mine was, I did qualified as a lawyer, did 2 years in private practice, and just didn't, we were talking about before, what loves what's what, I just didn't love what I was doing, frankly, and therefore I was like, right, I'm going to make a change. I think I'm much more suited to in-house type roles, and therefore went, right, I'm not going to let getting no's get me down. Apply for things that you really are passionate about and interested in. I've been very fortunate to work for a number of organisations. I worked for Southampton for a little while. Got to do comic relief, which is a very different world. No jokes needed on that. And also Stand Up To Cancer as part of Cancer Research UK. So I would certainly go, there isn't a one-size-fits-all. If I want to be in GC at a football club, I must follow this through. There's obviously, we'll come on to the tips in a minute, but my world was follow what you want to do. You'll be much better about providing the advice and stuff if you're really invested in it. Mm. And don't let time dim your kind of enthusiasm to do it. Mm. Would I like to have gone to be a private, an in-house lawyer at a football club on day one? Absolutely. But the opportunity wasn't there. Mm. So never let that get you down would be my thing is, yeah, lots of different contracting type roles, 6 months here, a year, 18 months there. And then when the opportunity came up, applied for it. Had a slightly strange thing that I applied, got through to the last two, then my predecessor stayed on for a year. And then I got a phone call a year later to say, you know, you were going to come and see us. Would you like to still do it? And it was, yeah, the job was great a year ago. I definitely still want to do it. And I'm 3.5 years into, for me, pretty much my perfect job. So.
Which in football is sort of like 30 years.
Yeah.
I won't go
through the number of managers that we've had in that time. But no, it is quite a long time. And the other thing is, never take it for granted as well. Like frankly, football clubs get bought and sold.
Yes.
Things change. I don't know whether I'll be there in 2 years, not from my side, but practically. Yeah. So embrace it. Enjoy every day you get there. Never feel entitled or have fun. And when the journey finishes, it'll be a great experience and you look for the next one. But yeah. Hopefully I'll be there for a long time to come. But if it changes, never let that get you down.
Yeah. Celia.
In terms of how I got here, yeah. I probably have a boring journey compared to others in the sense that, I grew up in Glasgow. That's not boring. Glasgow's great. But I did law at Glasgow and then went on to do more law and a master's degree and then came to London and became a lawyer. So it's not terribly exciting in that respect. Yeah, lots of law and then straight into what I consider also to be my dream job. Are we doing our three tips at this stage?
No, not yet. No, and you must mention, of course, that you came here as a pupil.
I did. Oh, sorry.
And then what happened?
I was a pupil at Blackstone Chambers. One of my supervisors was Nick DeMarco. So,
but the others didn't put you on.
And yeah, I've been here for a decade since,
yes,
which is sort of has flown by. Doing, you know, Chambers does a hugely broad range of work, so commercial, public, sports, media law, competition law, employment, the full spectrum of work. And I would say I've probably tried my hand at most of it. So yeah, tried all sorts of areas, and over time I'm starting to narrow down my practice. But happily, the lovely thing I think about sports as an area, sorry, I think we're back on now.
No,
question
go
one
on, yes.
Is what I was going to say is that actually sports lets you use all of those areas,
yes.
Because
yeah,
there are employment disputes, yeah. There are, you know, regulatory disputes that bring in the public law principles, there are competition disputes, it's the whole spectrum.
Everything, isn't there? Yeah. Ange.
So I went to uni at Northumbria in, I think it was 2013. I actually did a 4-year degree. So I did like my usual law degree, but I did my LPC and my master's integrated into the whole thing. I graduated in 2017, did a little bit of a stint in recruitment, which I think every student does nowadays, and then got a paralegal role or a legal assistant role, they called it back then, at Freeths, which is where I worked on the post office group litigation amongst other commercial litigation matters. And then that's when I started developing our sports practice there. I then moved, so I was in Leeds when I was at Freeths, and then I moved down to London about 3.5 years ago now, I would say, and then moved to Lawrence Stevens in December 2023 after meeting my boss, Mo, on a boxing and the law panel, which I think you...
Yes, I was on that.
Yeah, you moderated just some of the panels there. And then, yeah, since then, I've just been really refining my craft, getting more involved in obviously boxing, but also anti-doping and our entertainment side of the business, which is a lot of work for, I'd say, like influencers and, you know, their commercial agreements, which is very complementary to what we do with our athletes. So, that's me.
Great. Caroline.
So I did a law degree. I was at St. Anne's College in Oxford. So I kind of did the traditional thing, training contract, law school, and qualified as a company commercial lawyer in private practice. I then moved in. I did a secondment while I was in private practice to an industrial company. It wasn't sports related at all. Ended up then going in-house to AstraZeneca, a pharmaceutical company up in the Northwest. And it was fantastic. Brilliant in-house legal team there. Large, cross jurisdictions, you know, worldwide. Great opportunity. You could have stayed there for life. But I always had in my head, I wanted to be a sports media lawyer. Mm. That is kind of the area I wanted to do. But it was so hard to get into. So I could probably give away my age a bit. But it was really, there were very few firms at the time who had dedicated sports groups.
Yeah.
And they were really hard to get into. So I saw an advert one day, and it was in the lawyer, whatever, for IMG were looking for a legal counsel down in London. And I thought, I'm never going to get this. I'm working for a pharmaceutical company. Mm. How on earth are they ever? This is like the biggest sports marketing company in the world. There's no way. Anyway, for some reason, and I don't know how to this day, I just got on very well with the general counsel there, a guy called Brian Clark, who recently passed away. He was just a phenomenal sports lawyer, tax lawyer by trade. I don't know. I just got on well with him at the interview. And at the end of the interview, he was like, when do you want to start? And I was like, oh, God. So there was a bit of luck. So, you know, you sort of talk about stuff. I don't know whether I was just in the right place at the right time. So I kind of jumped ship, moved to London, half the salary, literally took this pay cut, could barely afford to find somewhere to live at the time, rented a room in a house, but absolutely loved it. And it gave me that first, you know, I was doing tennis, golf, and a bit of motorsport, because at the time, Brian looked after a lot of the Schumachers. And in the past, he'd looked after all the Ayrton Senna and all the big motorsport drivers. And he had all the helmets in his office. I always remember being sort of a bit wowed by it all. But anyway, so from there, I ended up moving back into private practice. So I've done a little bit strange journey to head up and to start a sports group at what's now Charles Russell Speechleys. So I started, they had a lot of sports clients, but they wanted somebody to come in and just run with it and kind of try to build it into a business group. So loved doing that. I was doing company commercial work for non-sports clients as well, and we were trying to build the group. And then a little bit further down the line, I saw an advert one day for British American Racing was looking for its first in-house senior counsel, team counsel, I think they called it. And I was loving what I was doing. I loved it, but it was those sort of opportunities didn't come up very often. And so I just applied, and I was really lucky. I got managed to get the role, joined as I was the sole legal counsel there for about 4 or 5 years before I started to recruit a team. British American Racing became Honda, which became Braun, which is now Mercedes. So I was there for 13 years. And so that journey was phenomenal, and I kind of saw it through changes in ownership, different cultures because of the different owners that we had, and building a team, winning like 4 or 5 world championships while I was there, which was just an amazing experience. Then got called out of the blue one day about a football job, a new role that was coming up at Leicester, and I'd kind of been in F1 for a long time. I thought, gosh, 13 years, is it time for me to try something different?
football is always that area when you're a sports lawyer, it was a little bit, oh, so much is going on in football. And I feel like maybe it'd be great to really be involved in a team and really understand sort of sports side from a football point of view. So I spent a bit of time at Leicester, which was fantastic. I was their first general counsel, worked, you know, learned so much in a short space of time, really steep learning curve. Then had an opportunity. I'm from the Midlands originally. Birmingham were awarded the Commonwealth Games right on my doorstep. I'd never done anything to do with the Olympics and felt that maybe as a sports lawyer, it was something I'd have loved to have done. Commonwealth Games was the next best thing, really. And it was right on my doorstep, right from where I was brought up. And I felt that it was just one of this one-off opportunities that if I didn't take it, I wouldn't maybe never get the chance again, because there maybe was never going to be another multi-sport event in the UK, perhaps for another 10 or so years. So, and I remember speaking to Susan Whelan, CEO of Leicester at the time, and trying to explain, and she says, I totally understand why this is something that's different. Mm. So that was a 4-year gig, really. I knew it was going to be a limited period of time, which for a lawyer is kind of, you know, I've probably taken a few risks in my sort of decision making, my career decision making over the years, is that not everything I've taken, I know that it was going to be a long term. But actually, I've always sort of think, you know, if you try to plan out everything too much, it doesn't always happen. So I've always been a little bit, do you know what? Let's give it a go. And I'll worry about it in 4 years' time what I do next. You know, I kind of just thought it's just too good an opportunity and a one-off opportunity. So from the Commonwealth Games, that finished. And then I then kind of got lured back into Formula One, which I'd never thought, I'm not saying never say never that I would come back into it, but I think the whole sort of Cadillac story and the challenge of being involved in trying to get a new team to the grid was something different. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was using the skills that I'd acquired in my whole 13 years at Mercedes, and I did a stint at Alpine as well on a number of key projects there, to kind of using those skills together with everything that I'd learned from other sports, which is phenomenal. And actually leaving a sport and learning how other sports do things has, I think, made me a better sports lawyer, because I understand how other sports do things, and you're always learning. So hopefully then, so this was a new challenge for me, and we were a startup. So that was something totally different again, like starting from the ground up and building what hopefully will be quite a unique Formula One team across two, from the US and the UK. Yeah. It's never really been done before. And to try and make a little bit of history again, be a little bit a part of that. So yeah, a bit varied. I think a bit of luck, a bit of perseverance, but also a few little risks in my career that maybe lawyers don't normally always do. Yeah. But I kind of, in hindsight, now I look back, I think I did make quite a lot of decisions that maybe other people might thought I was a bit mad at the time. But, you know,
it's all worked out.
I wouldn't have changed any of them.
I have to ask you, Caroline, as you've worked at the top of so many sports, what's the kind of big difference between, or similarity, or what do you notice as a sort of variation between working in Formula One, football, athletics? What's the is it just applying the same skill set in a different way, or what?
It's, do you know what, all of them are very different, and you're dealing with different clients. There's obviously different rules and regulations, so you've got a lot to learn each time you do something, whether it's, you know, you're getting to grips with all the football regulations, or, you know, you're going into Commonwealth Games and you have to understand how the Commonwealth Games Federation does things and what the host city contract, how that all works, and there's how all the different sports as well, like you're learning more about all the individual sports and how they're governed, because you're dealing with all of the individual sporting governing bodies as well. So there are a lot of differences. The similarities are that there will always be your standard commercial contracts that you've got to do, that are your core legal work, you know, that regardless of whether you're working in a sporting entity or not, you still have to do the legal stuff at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. It just happens to be in a slightly more exciting environment. What's interesting between Formula One and football is in football, the players are employees. Mm. In Formula One, they're not.
Yes.
That's kind of a little bit of a difference that people don't always realise, that in Formula One, they are independent contractors. So you're doing different, and you've got more flexibility in how you contract with your drivers compared to in football, where you're a bit more restricted because you've got different regulations. And yeah, so the... But I just think I love the variety between it all. I think it makes it fascinating, and it makes sport so different. No matter what your area you're working in, there's always something new to learn, which gets you out of bed every day, yeah, knowing that you're learning something new. So
absolutely. Okay, so three top tips, or even two top tips if you'd rather have two, for anyone listening that you would give of how to get into the sports industry as a lawyer. Ian?
Certainly, as we've been talking about, open to new opportunities. Like, don't fixate on just one thing. Like, give it a chance. If you want to get into sports, try if there's an opportunity that comes up in cricket or in swimming or in football. Like, give it a go. There's always the ability to move across different disciplines at time. Two, if you're going to apply for a job, make sure you show that you've not just sent the same CV and covering letter to every single place and changed the name. Because it's one of the things that, obviously, certain times of the year, you just get a feeling. I've had CVs that have come in, covering letters that have come in with the wrong club's name top of it. It's the kind of thing.
Yes.
And I'll politely drop them an email back saying, actually, just be careful. Not in a critical way, but just as we've all been there, we all appreciate that I'm not the only club you're looking to work for if there's an opportunity. But just take that care, make it actually tailored to that person. And following on from that, I think actually relationships and building contacts within, so things like the Law in Sport, like conferences, absolutely amazing. That's where a lot of the opportunities come up with, because you know someone, they say, oh, actually, a friend of mine, and frankly, there is a big world that people know each other at different places across sport. You'll hear about an opportunity. Someone will be like, oh, I'm looking for a paralegal. And you'll remember that person that you've met, or you go, actually, Chris or whoever, I think they might really like, let me just drop them a message. And you get LinkedIn, obviously things like LinkedIn and stuff, you can follow people on when new posts and stuff, but really build genuine connections rather than just, I want to connect with you because I'm then going to send you generic CV in two minutes. Like, ask questions, learn from it, and give it a go. If it doesn't work for you, reality is you can always step away and do something different.
Yeah. Excellent. Thanks, Ange. Your tip.
Following on from that is, be present be present in the industry. Attend as many networking opportunities as you can. I'd say if you've got a real interest in one particular sport, I would make sure that I'm at those events. So me and boxing, I'd say every other weekend. I'm a fight, it's actually ridiculous at this point. But that's the way that people, you know, they remember your face. If you're having conversations, they know what you're like. Especially if you're like backstage tending to other fighters, then, you know, other potential clients or connects will know that you are a trusted person in that particular industry, and that's what's going to get you far. I would also say, know your stuff. Like, ultimately, we are lawyers. You've got to know what you're talking about, ultimately, whether that's being a corporate lawyer or you're a contentious lawyer. You've just got to know your stuff. Okay, you might not know the nuances of a particular sport, but if you know procedure and you know how things work in practice, then ultimately the client is going to have the most trust in you. That's what I'd say.
Caroline?
Really, really similar, actually. Yeah. So for fear of repeating it, I say get those core legal foundational skills there first.
Yeah.
You know, don't worry too much, first of all, about which industry you maybe want to work in, but get the core foundation. So as you say, you know whether... And it's those transferable skills in those areas that you know are going to be useful in a sporting environment. And then it's really, you know, be out there, try, you know, offer up work experience, offer yourself up to, particularly as a younger lawyer, you know, go for those opportunities, really, you know, do your research, understand the sports and be present, as you say, be there at these networking opportunities if you can. There's loads more now out there as well for students and more sort of younger lawyers starting out in this sort of area, which is so many more opportunities than years ago, which is brilliant. And also it's making those meaningful connections. I mean, the sport industry is quite a small world, actually. You'll always come across people, the number of people that I've come across all the different areas that I've worked in. Keep in contact with everybody insofar as you can. Those key people, communicate with them, keep in those circles where you're going to meet the people who might be making the decisions about a role where you might be putting yourself forward for. And really just, as I say, that sort of close-knit community, once you're kind of in there and you're making those connections and you're contacting people will remember you then. They'll remember your name, you know. And when you send your CV in, it'd be like, oh, that's that person I met at, you know, at that event last week. And we had a really interesting conversation with them. And it was really, they really knew their stuff and they'd really read it up on this area. And it was fascinating. And you'll be remembered so, because it is hard because there are now so many more people who want to get into this area, I think. Absolutely. It's just, isn't it? It's really competitive. And you kind of have to try and stand out a little bit from that crowd, which is difficult. Yeah. It's,
And following on from that, I think that works both ways around. The really positive experiences get remembered, but negative ones would do as well.
Yes.
So even if it's not, this is my be all and end all, actually, if you are not putting the effort in or not doing those things, it does get remembered. Mm. Like, always just take pride in what you do. And I think exactly that, like kind of be good at the basics. You can always then build on having that trust and the personal connections as well in terms of building up connections rather than you have to know someone to get in. It's definitely the way to go. So for example, just using again with Watford, like my paralegal worked in our commercial team for a year as part of his university degree. But because actually the reports I get from him and when I'm dealing with bits of work, it's really positive. Then he steps across from one team into a totally different team. He's now got a full-time job there. It would work the other way around. If it's doesn't take the attention to detail, he's always the first to leave type world, that gets passed on.
Yeah.
And if someone at another club phoned me up and said, oh, I know so-and-so used to work with you, what were they actually like in the office? Because you can look at a CV and you can finesse your CV and be great. But actually that sort of testimonial from someone carries a lot of weight.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Celia, your tips?
I mean, very similar themes. I think tip one, perseverance, which is there is almost no one that has got to somewhere worth being that hasn't in the process fallen down or got kicked in the teeth. So just get back up and give it another go. Not least because I really do think having a thick skin, certainly if you want to be a litigator, is half the battle. Tip two, I would say continue to grow. I find, for example, some of the things I've heard to hear today about moving industries, changing plans, you know, shaking things up, really trying to change what it is you're doing, so inspiring. Because I think there's such a danger of wanting to be a big fish in a small pond or just letting yourself become a big fish in a small pond. And for loads of people that really works, but equally you never know when the next thing that comes along that's going to be interesting and challenging and actually take your effectively your skill set to a new level. So keep pushing yourself. And I suppose as a third and general tip, try and be professionally proud, which is effectively, it's really hard to continue to throw yourself into the brick wall, which is certainly what litigation feels like sometimes.
Yeah.
But actually getting up with renewed energy to do that day after day in the interests of your client and, you know, to do it with energy and enthusiasm and passion. I really think it's the job and it's the only way to do the job. Everything can't be a chore or a task. You have to actually really want to do it. Be professionally proud.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much. And we've talked for over our hour, well over, but it hasn't seemed like it because it's been fascinating and I've really enjoyed it. So I'm sure all our listeners have. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Sports Law Podcast with me, Nick DiMarco of Blackstone Chambers. For more information, you can find me on Twitter and LinkedIn. And of course, visit our website at www.blackstonechambers.com.